alcoholic. Yeah, thanks for having me again and being here, some of you at least. what I was trying to focus on a bit the last time I was here was it's kind of the more practical aspects of my experience about working with others. The 12th step in the Big Book is having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. We tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. So basically the 12 steps are three parts. And I just want to kind of reiterate that. And I believe that, you know, our rigorous 12-step work is the best kept hidden secret in Alcoholics Anonymous. I think that we're not doing it on a grand scale in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I think that's why many of us relapse. I think a lot of the reasons why people have a hard time later in recovery is because they don't work with others. I am basing this on my experience working with a lot of people with time. I've sponsored a lot of people with time, like, you know, more than 10 years, more than 15 years. And and they've, this is back home in Iceland, and this, they've come to me because they, you know, I guess because I was enthusiastic about the program, and I was enthusiastic about this fellowship. And that's something they felt they needed. And sometimes these guys I worked with had, you know, had achieved the spiritual experience, maybe not working through the book like we've been talking about, you know, step by step, but they achieved it through various, you know, means. Their God, as they understood them, guided them through this process. You know, there's more than one way to skin a cat, and that's fine. But the problem they were having is they didn't know or didn't have any methods or means to transmit the program. And I don't know if we talked about this before, but it's hard if you like do your seventh step by losing a part of your finger somewhere, you know, and then you do the fifth step in a workshop in India somewhere through, you know what I'm saying? So if you do this work through a non-linear process, it's really hard to transmit that. It's really hard to send every sponsor you have to India, to a workshop. You know what I'm saying? You can't go and chop everybody's finger off to give them their seven-step experience or the six-step experience. So these people I was working with, the main thing I think I managed to give them was not necessarily that vital spiritual experience, but the access to that, or the means to go to that vital spiritual experience, but more just a method to work with a new guy, you know, something, because it's hard to meet with a newcomer and, you know, and have nothing concrete to give him, and you don't know how to give him what you've got. You don't know, and you don't have anything organized or concrete to relate to him, so you end up telling him a lot of, you know, phrases, a lot of stuff from self-help books or areas you're reading at the time, and a lot of stuff from Oprah Winfrey, if you like to watch that. And those are all beautiful things, but usually they're not, you know, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And just, you know, with these guys I worked with, just when they had that kind of, when they had these tools to work with, they all expressed such relief, not having to be witty and deep all the time. They could just go to the book, you know what I'm saying? And not having to watch Oprah anymore, unless they wanted to, of course. It's so simple. The program's just in the book, and we can use that. And then we use our experience, of course. And that's a really easy, kind of foolproof way to transmit the spiritual experience. I think another aspect of the 12-step is or working with others, is it's one of these interesting things, and I don't know if I said this before. I say these things to a lot of people, so I might be repeating myself, but I hope not. that it's interesting. This is the most potent approach we have to help ourselves, working with others in Alcoholics Anonymous. But when we get sick of our alcoholism, you know, or the spiritual malady part of our alcoholism, we feel we're not worthy to work with others, right? We get that feeling that, well, I'm so messed up, you know, I'm feeling like this, I'm feeling like that, I'm not doing this, I'm not doing that. So, you know, I start feeling like I'm not worthy or I shouldn't be working with others, right? Because I can't transmit what I haven't got. So, you know, and sometimes that's the way I understand this. And so I feel I need to get well in order to get well, right? Because the most potent tool I have is to work with others to get well. But I'm denying myself to do that, right? I worked in oncology. I was helping people that were pretty sick with cancer. And none of them said, oh, don't give me any medication for the cancer until the cancer gets a little bit smaller. You know what I'm saying? None of them said that. They wanted the medication, right, to get the cancer smaller. They didn't wait. Well, I just want to get this tumor down to a reasonable size on my own here, and then you can give me the medication, right? No, that never happened. The same with pain. You know, let me get this pain here. Wait until the pain goes down a little bit. Then I'm going to be worthy to get the pain medication. Nope. No, just give me that stuff. You know what I'm saying? I'll take it. But for some strange reason, I get to thinking, you know, that I need to, you know, to get better, to be able to do the things I need to do to get better. That makes no sense. But I don't know if you've experienced this or not. I've noticed this throughout the years, that this is a pretty common insanity with us. And it's an insanity. Because if we've gone through the work, we can transmit it, you know. I know no more potent way to get better if I'm starting to get spiritually sick than work with another alcoholic. And this is not rocket science. You know. I do not need to by osmosis transfer to him some divine spiritual energy, you know. I just need to give him some experience and some information. That's it. Of course, you know, if I'm walking on water, maybe that'll help. But that's certainly not a prerequisite to working with others. Most of us would be drunk if it would be, right? At least I have a couple of days each year that I don't walk on water. I don't know about you guys. So, you know, it's an interesting phenomenon. We get sick and we feel we're not worthy. And I think, like I talked about before, once the idea that the foundation, you know, stone in my recovery is ingrained in me, and once I've seen that happen to other people around me, they hardly get drunk. They hardly get drunk. If that's the first thing they turn to when shit hits the fan, when life starts happening, and we start feeling that way or this way, you know, if that's the first thing we turn to, we turn to God and we turn to working with others. You know, then if that's your initial response to hardship, I think you're in a good place, according to my experience. You know, if our first reaction is to, oh, I'm going to change my sponsor, change a home group, change, you know, my job, change a geographical location, you know, talk to this guru or that guru, talk to this speaker I heard there because he's the only one qualified enough to help me because I'm so freaking special and complicated. That's so well, and it could be. It could be you should change your jobs. It could be you should do that stuff. You know, I don't know. But the initial thought, at least for me, is go and work in with others, you know. And hopefully that guru that I talked to somewhere is going to tell, you know, why are you calling me? Why aren't you trying to reach a newcomer and work with him? If you have that solution. Of course, if you haven't experienced the spiritual experience, if you haven't experienced the awakening, if you haven't gone through the work, you know, I suggest you try to do so and check it out. At least, you know, what have we got to lose? I always say, I always try to greet all the newcomers I meet in meetings and talk to them. And if I talk about being chronic relapser or relapsers having a tough history, and then I ask them, well, have you gone through the work and the book? And they say, no. And I say, well, that's great. Great news. It really is. And I just say that. And they're like, yeah, they haven't tried it. At least they haven't, you know, at least they have that option still open. They can check that out, you know. And then there's hope. You know, there's hope. If they haven't tried to go through the work, well, it's not an illogical thing to do, right? After all, you know, our fellowship was named after the book. This is the basic text of our fellowship. You know, it's not a really original or strange idea to kind of read through the book and follow the directions in. So, I was gonna use this time a little bit to talk about my experience in trying to work with others and trying to do this work while, you know, with life happening around me. And of course my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous was that I told you this last time, that I didn't get a lot of sponsees to work with in the beginning. And it did not work for me to sit around, you know, on the sidelines like a shy 16-year-old waiting for the newcomers to pick me up, right? I had to go out there aggressively, not aggressive to the newcomer, but aggressively to myself, you know, and go one step beyond what I dared to do, and, you know, greet the newcomer, you know? And it's not really complicated. Just wherever I am, if there's a new guy there, I try to, you know, I try to greet him, and I try to follow the directions in chapter 7, find out a little about him if I can, and give him my number, and then I kind of use my good judgment, how much I talk or not. You know, sometimes you get that feeling that guy doesn't want to be approached more, and I'm respectful to that, of course, you know. But if I don't approach him that initial time and greet him and, you know, start a little conversation, I never know that. Because some of them are really, you know, dying for some contact. Some of them have been to a lot of meetings and nobody's talked to them. You know, nobody shook their hand. And that's why they're feeling, that's why they're looking kind of, you know, put off. That's why they're looking kind of scary to approach me. And I know I was. When I got sober, I thought I was a dangerous guy. I was on probation, you know what I'm saying? My head shaved. I was a big guy, you know, with a kind of a dark past, I felt, you know, and I looked at everybody like they beat up my mother yesterday, you know. I thought that was kind of cool. With this sensitive face, I can't imagine how I thought that would work out. But still, you know. And then I stood around these rooms, you know, with a completely shaved head, and I was like a large Russian winter overcoat, you know what I'm saying? Looking all, you know, trying to look all mean. And so it's hard to approach guys like that. And then if somebody would come and approach me, I was so freaking scared. I would usually, you know, answer them in an arrogant, disrespectful manner. But I still really appreciate them coming greeting me. You know what I'm saying? I really appreciated that. And they weren't pushing anything. They weren't peddling anything. They were just simply bidding me welcome, you know, and you know, I'm here if you want to. And that's what I tried to do and how I tried to approach it. And I don't know, a newcomer coming into a meeting and not being greeted and not being paid attention to, that's just an atrocity in my mind. I have no tolerance for that. I just think it's horrible if that happens. It's horrendous, and I don't know what the heck the people in that meeting are doing. God bless them. Because if we're not doing that, if we're in a meeting and we're not, and we have some time, we have some solution. If we're not paying attention to the guy, what are we doing? Why are we there? What's the purpose of the meeting? What is our primary purpose? And I felt that when I came over here, I felt discomfort trying to, you know, I have a teeny bit of an accent, if anybody noticed. You know, I had a discomfort going up to the newcomers initially that introduced themselves, you know. Who am I? Who do I think I am? You know what I'm saying? Like, am I trying to be a big shot here, greeting the newcomers? You know, but it's not about that. It's not about being anything like that. It's just about, this is what I do when I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous. This is where my focus is. Not because I'm so holy and, you know, I have so great ideals, just because experience has taught me that nothing works as well for my alcoholism as having that focus, right? It's nothing more complicated than that. Sometimes I do it, you know, for lofty ideals, but, you know, 9 out of 10 times I just do it because I'm there. I do it because I know it works. And I do it because I know nothing works better. Well, anyway, in the beginning, I didn't get a lot of sponsees. I didn't have a family. I was working a job with flexible hours, you know, stuff like that. I moved back home, you know, stuff like that. So I had a lot of time to go to a lot of meetings. And I was in a meeting, you know, every day. I was out there, you know what I'm saying? It's like, it's kind of like being a deputant or something. You know, you're just out there and you're getting to know the people, you're getting acquainted with the place, you're kind of learning about the culture, you know, different personalities, different cliques and AA, all that stuff. And so I could do that. And that's how I did my 12-step. You know, I went to a lot of, I didn't have a lot of sponsees. I just participated a lot in AA. I went to the coffee shop before and after that. I, you know, talked to the new guys there. You know, I talked to my friends that were trying to get sober or stuff like that. That's how I got the 12-step book done. Going to a lot of meetings, trying to approach the newcomer in the best manner or the, you know, best way I could. And then, you know, people around me needing help. And that worked for me. I was fine. I don't need to be a sponsor to stay sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. I just need to be sincerely trying to work with or help another alcoholic. I don't necessarily need to be a sponsor. Often, that's kind of a logical consequence of reaching out, is you end up as a sponsor. You know what I'm saying? But at least according to my experience, that's not a necessity. The main thing is I'm sincerely trying to reach out there. As I got sober for a longer time, as my spiritual experience kind of kicked in, and it really kicked in after working with others for about 8 months, something like that. 6-8 months after I've been working with others pretty consistently for that time, that's where I got my real, you know, strong spiritual experience. After doing that for a while, I started picking up some guys to work with, you know, and then more guys. And I kept going to the meetings, you know, and I kept going to detoxes, I kept going to treatment centers, all that stuff. Then I started, you know, college, and I met my wife, and that changed a little bit how I did things, right? I couldn't attend as many meetings because they're on a fixed schedule and all that stuff. But I was working a lot with newcomers, and that seemed to increase. What I learned is that it is really important for me to keep some sort of balance in my life, you know, and for me to follow my third step, what I sincerely believe is God's will in my life. And I sincerely believed that God wanted me to go to college. I'm not saying that's God's will for you guys. I'm just saying I believe that's God's will for me at that time, right? And I sincerely believe that God wanted me to be in this relationship and to, you know, kind of be the best boyfriend and later, you know, fiancé and husband that I could be. And so that's what I did. And I still did AA, because if I wasn't doing AA, if I wasn't doing my 12-step work, that would not work. right? I wouldn't have the power, I wouldn't have the spiritual health to be that guy, you know? And so, you know, that continued. I did a four-year degree, undergraduate degree. I continued with my wife when I was, when we had been together for 3 years and I'd been through 3 years of school. We had a kid, you know? Didn't plan on it specifically, you know, but clearly had a kid, so he must have done something. And that again changed things, you know. I wasn't going out to the bar with my friends, you know, so I didn't have to stop doing that. But I was doing a lot of AA work. I was involved with the Al Anon Club. I was in the board of directors there for 3 years. I was doing general service work. Well, at least what we refer to as general service in Iceland. And I was sponsoring a lot of guys. And I was always working with newcomers. And what kind of changed for me at the time is at that point, I had enough guys, and I know we talked a little bit about that last time, but I had enough guys staying sober for enough time that, and they kept calling me. They didn't call me every day. We weren't meeting a lot, although I met them occasionally if needed be. But they wanted spiritual accountability. They wanted continued sponsorship in their recovery. And so they stayed in touch a bit. And as those guys, because what tends to happen if guys do the work from the book, they tend to stay sober. Isn't that strange? So gradually, after 3-4 years, I started having quite a few guys that I was working with on a continuous basis. And that reduced the time I had to work with new guys. I felt, though, that if I didn't work with a newcomer, too, I stagnated a bit. You know, if I was only doing the work with the guys that were already in the program, my experience is that it limited my view a bit, and I felt I was stagnated a bit. So I always tried to keep one new guy I was working with. But that's it. Since that time, I've only worked with, you know, one new newcomer each time. And it just kind of came about as we had a baby and the other sponsees kind of grew a little bit in numbers. Necessity kind of forced me to go that route. That may change or may not change in the future, but that's where it ended up. And I think I talked about the reasons for that the last time. Now, having a kid and trying to be the father I thought God would want me to be, that also meant time, right? All this stuff means time. And that means time I was doing something else with before. And in my case, that something else was mostly spent in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I was fortunate to the point that, you know, I got my 12-step home delivered at that point, right? And I have quite a few sponsees that got their sobriety with my son in their lap, right? My son's probably heard the Big Book read more often than most AAs. And he was like a really Buddha-like child, so he would just sit there like for the first 18 months and not do anything. So that was pretty convenient, and that was, you know, clearly something I needed since that's the way it was. And so I started more to invite the guys I was working with into my house, into my home. And I feel that has a real spiritual significance, that they're a part of what I do. You know, they're sitting there often with my son in their lap, you know what I'm saying? We're reading the book. They're in my home. They're in my sanctuary, if you will. They're there where I, you know, spend time with my wife, and, you know, where any any, you know, spiritual truth about me is going to be quick to surface, right? And I just think it has a lot of meaning to invite a newcomer to that place, and it just says a lot, I think, to him, to how much he matters to me. You know, not maybe personally at the time, although that may come, but just how much it matters to me to be working with a new guy. You know, it's a part of who I am. It's a part of my family. It's a part of keeping everything together. I'm well aware of. I know what kind of guy gets drunk. I know what type of alcoholic goes out and gets drunk. It's a type like me, right? That's the type. And I'm aware of this. I'm aware of that. If I wouldn't be sober, I'm the kind of alcoholic, and I can say this, and it's true. If I'm not sober, I lose most of the things I have today. And it would happen pretty quickly because of the way I drink. And that's just the truth. So, you know, having the newcomer, having the guys I work with as a part of my close environment, inviting them to my home, I felt that's really important. Now, I've been doing that for quite a few years, and, you know, there have been one or two guys I haven't invited to my house right away. because of their history, you know, and because I know my wife wouldn't feel comfortable with them being there. But always, as you know, and that's just me being respectful of, you know, my family, basically being considerate. But and you know, many times I will maybe meet the guy the first time someplace else if I know my family's going to be at the house. But you know, eventually it always happens that they start coming there, you know, and they meet my family. You know? They may be, you know, eat dinner with us, or, you know, they take a ride with me picking up my son from preschool, or, you know, put, you know, whatever. It's, I'm really fond of that process. And the guys I've been working with for a longer time, I do stuff with them. I was staying at one sponsor's house, when I got back to Iceland. He wasn't there, but, you know, he lent me his house for a week. And while I was there, I was staying with another family, and that guy and his wife and his two kids, that guy's my sponsee. He's been my sponsee for 8 years now. And I've had probably three sponsees, you know, that have visited me while I'm here in the U.S., and I have probably seven or eight guys that call me on a regular basis. And that just, that's a pretty, for me, that's a pretty unique feeling, you know. Not because they're addicted to my opinion or, you know, that I tell them how to run their lives, because that's not a part of my job description. But rather that we have a relationship that kind of matters to us, and, you know, they know I know their shit, and they know me, and they can trust that I'll hopefully most of the time will be coming from, you know, a specific angle, but I'll be talking, hopefully be talking about this program when they call, and that's the, you know, that's the direction, and that I know what my job is. And my job is not to advise them in their relationships or have an opinion about the psychiatric medication they're taking. My job is solely about sharing my experience with the work in this book, you know. And if they if they need their teeth fixed, or, you know, they need relationship advice, there are professionals who can do that. Or, like we talked about before, they can call their mom or their grandmom or whatever, you know. People who can have an opinion about that stuff. I don't. I might have experiences on the subject and how to approach the solution, but I'm not going to tell them how to run their lives. It was pretty interesting for me transitioning from having a kid. I graduated from college in 2004, and I had 2 years where I was working. I did some exercise, I took care of my family, and I did AA. And it was a pretty peaceful period, you know. I, 2 years, and what I do is I try to, you know, my chosen profession is at least feebly trying to help other people. So that's basically what I was doing all day. You know, I was trying to do that at work, and then I got home, and I was trying to do that. I got guys at my home most of the time, most nights. And I had a home group. I had one home group, and that's the way I've kept it for many years. And that's basically like I talked about, in the first 18 months, 2 years, I was all over the place. Because I could, right? After, you know, I started doing other things too, focusing on other things, that changed for me. And since that time, I've had one home group. And I only attend one AA meeting a week. Because there's nothing specific for me that goes on in an AA meeting that I need on a let's say more frequent basis than once a week. There's a fellowship, there's some accountability, you know, there's of course social relationship, all that stuff. And relationships that mean a lot to me. But the real stuff I need, I get from working with a new guy, you know, or get working with guys, you know, one-on-one, preferably if I can. And so that's where my main focus is. And I never go to meetings just to go to meetings. I go to meetings if I need to get some 12-step work done. You know. And so my focus is not on going to a lot of meetings, and it can't, and like I talked about, it can't be an excellent way to do a lot of 12-step work. You know. But if I'm just going there to hang out there, my time is probably, at least now, at where I presently am in my life, my time is probably better spent doing something else. If I talk a little bit about my home group, another interesting thing about working with others is how important it is to have access to newcomers and to have a group that's actively doing, you know, work and actively participating in that. I would have a hard time being a part of a group where I was the only one greeting the newcomer, unless I was like in a remote town somewhere and so we only, you know, meeting in town. I think it's really important how my home group presents itself to, you know, to doing the 12-step work. And that's really important to me. We started our meeting back home. It's a man's meeting. It's called Man Among Men. That's a direct translation. We started it on December 20th in 99. About 2.5 years after we started, we were 15 guys who started it. About 2.5 years, we were 180 guys in that meeting. And we were all young guys, you know, ages maybe 18. Sometimes we had like younger guys than that, up to 40 maybe, and all full of testosterone. And it was a beautiful thing. You can imagine 180 guys doing the Serenity Prayer. You could hear it miles away. Especially young guys, you know, and all kind of still preaching fire about the Big Book, right? We knew the truth and you didn't, right? That was kind of our approach there for a while. and we did a lot of experimentation in our group. And, you know, in the beginning, what we used to do, and I guess still sometimes occurs, this is an open discussion meeting. And it's not really an open discussion meeting because we have a have a chair who chooses a leader, and the leader is always from the group. He speaks for 10 to 15 minutes. Then he chooses guys he wants to hear from, and our conscience has decided that we don't want to hear from anybody that the leader doesn't know approximately what he's going to say. Right? So there's no rolling of the dice there. The leader is going to know that the guy he's picking up is going to carry the message, and if he chooses somebody else, that's fine, but it's not going to be fun being him for the next few weeks at our meeting, and he's going to get to hear it at our business meeting. I'm not saying this is the right approach, I'm just saying this is the approach we take, right, and has worked for us. Because what used to happen is that we used to clap and holler people down from the podium, and you can imagine being a relatively new guy, you know, with with a history like some of us had, with a lot of drug use, being in jail, all that stuff, and you come into a meeting, and there are 180 guys there, and you know some of them from the streets or from wherever you are, and then you go up and you try to do the stuff you were taught in therapy to do, share like you did in therapy about your day and about your car breaking down, and they start hollering at you, like after 30 seconds, shut up, sit down, you know what I'm saying, stuff like that, and then if you keep on going, after about 2 minutes, they're going to start to clap. Somebody's going to start to clap. And then somebody else is going to join in. And then after about 30 seconds, you have like 150 guys clapping while you're trying to share your message. Talking about tough love, right? So, I know some of us miss the drama involved in doing this, you know. So when we rarely do this now because we felt it was unfair to a newcomer. You know, we felt this was okay to do with guys who should know better, right? But we felt this was kind of violent to a newcomer who didn't know any better and was sincerely trying to do his best carrying this message. Kind of harsh, you know. So we rarely do this now, and the way we try to keep the message pretty clear in our meeting is through the method I was telling you about. We have a leader who's from the core of the group, means he's been in the group for 1 year at a minimum most of the time. and he knows what the guys he's taking up to the podium, he knows what they're going to say. Now, like with every big group, what happened is that we had a lot of groups kind of breaking off from our group, joining other groups, starting other groups, starting other L&O clubs. I think there are probably 4 L&O clubs now in Iceland, and the first one was started in 2000. And so we, as I said, we have a lot of break-off groups, and our meeting, our mammoth of a meeting, it went down, and it's now about 100 guys, something like that, 80 to 100 guys. And it was kind of interesting, and it has to do with working with others a bit, I guess, because I know some members of the home group kind of were scared about that. You know what I'm saying? Going on? Are we doing something wrong? All that stuff. Why aren't we popular anymore? I guess I like my group a little bit better after it got down, because it got to be a little bit of a freak show that people showed up in to see kind of a show, to see somebody being, you know, clapped down from the podium, all that stuff. But The main thing I think is important about our group, that the guys in our group do a lot of 12-step work. And we don't spend the time, you know, those precious 10 minutes before and after the meeting hugging and kissing each other. You know? And we talk about this all the time in our business meeting. You know, if somebody old, you know, that's been in the group for a long time comes up to me right after the meeting, I'm just going to duck and push him away, right? Because I need to go after that new guy. I need to go after the new guy who's trying to get out of there before somebody approaches them. But still, he wants somebody to approach him, but still he wants to get out of there, right? So what we do is we line up, you know, where the exit from the meeting is. We line up there. Probably 10 of us, 15 of us, something like that, when we say the serenity prayer. So nobody gets out without talking to us. And I can guarantee if you go to that meeting, you might not understand the message, but you're going to be talked to. And you're going to be greeted, and you're going to be given some contact information. And you're going to be given the option, the possibility to get to this work if you want to. And there's going to be people there that are doing it and have been doing it for a long time. And some haven't been doing it for a long time, but are enthusiastic about this program. We had the experience with this that that we used to, and we always lose some of the guys. They come to our meeting, they get the spiritual experience, they get all riled up, and then a year passes, something like that, a year and a half, and then they get vice and all mature, and then they don't want to be in our meeting anymore because it's so immature. And and they don't have the tolerance towards the guys that are now like they were a year ago, right? Because they're so, you know what I'm saying, they're so intolerant, they're so like this and like that, so preachy and all that stuff. Well, and it's been interesting, and I know most of us who stayed in this group have the attitude that, this is this seems to be a somewhat unavoidable side effect of getting a spiritual awakening. You know, well, you know, we do everything we can to help these guys get the power that propels the universe into their lives. Well, it's going to have a small effect on their emotional life. They're going to get a bit riled up. They're going to get passionate. They're going to get enthusiastic. It's a beautiful thing. It might not always be pretty, you know. It might come with some side effects that, you know, aren't always nice. But that's going to go away, and that's going to pass. And if we're not there, if we're not there to role model how to go past that stage, and I'm not saying it's a bad stage, I'm just saying usually we kind of move beyond that after a while, then what's the point? You know what I'm saying? How is AA going to move beyond just being there, being, you know? So I really love that stage because I spent a lot of time in that stage. I'm still kind of, you know, and I'm still enthusiastic and riled up about this deal. And I don't know. I just have a lot of tolerance towards that. And I think it's important that we do as a fellowship, you know, that there's a lot of tolerance to be being on fire towards Alcoholics Anonymous, to having passion, to being enthusiastic. Although other people might call those very same things being judgmental and arrogant. You know what I'm saying? I don't see it like that. I don't see it like that at all. And I think the main thing is that we're sincerely trying to work with other alcoholics. That's it. That's the matter. And the thing is, you know, I've seen a lot of guys go through that stage and then revolt into it so much that they completely, you know, leave the things that used to keep them sober, that kept them sane, you know, leave the very core of what gave them that, you know, that passion. And that's not a pretty thing either, you know. To see a light go out like that, that's a goddamn shame. And it's sad. It really is, you know. What happened then is we came here to the United States, and you know, I did a lot of work in Alcoholics Anonymous in Iceland, and in kind of the, if I may say, the more big book leaning crowd in Iceland, there's not a lot of sobriety, so I had a lot of sobriety, you know. And I was kind of like, I and a lot of other people, of course, were functioning as an old timer stuff. Then I come to America and I have like 8 years. It's like, come on. That's not even warming up, right? That's hardly a good start. just a little bit, but maybe, you know. And I didn't have guys lining up again. I was, again, in the same position as I was a newcomer. I was getting used to that. You know what I'm saying? I had my little home group. I'd been there, you know, since we started it. A lot of 20 newcomers per meeting. It was not a problem at all to get a newcomer, you know. And they came, the 12-step came through home delivery to my house, like I explained. You know? And now I was here, and I was starting graduate school, you know, and we were in a new country, no support system, no babysitting, nothing like that, and another continent, didn't know anybody here. So I couldn't do the same thing as I did when I was new, right? I couldn't go to 2 meetings a day. Well, I couldn't do that and stay in graduate school and stay married to my wife. You know what I'm saying? All at the same time. So what ended up happening for me is I was pretty concrete about the 12 step. And as you hopefully hear, I'm passionate about it. I think it's the most important thing in my recovery. And I used to count my 12 steps. I used to take one session like this, and that was 1 hour. If I met a newcomer, that was 1 hour. If I did, you know, other kinds of service work, that was 1 hour. I used to do at least 30 of those every month for probably 4 or 5 years. Probably more than that, but I was counting it. I could do an Excel spreadsheet for you guys because I counted it, you know, for that time. You know? So I always did more than 30. And I wasn't doing that. I wasn't doing that when I got here. I'm not doing that now. And it was quite kind of a good lesson for me that although the 12 step is so important, you know, God is more important. And I believe that God wanted me to come here. I believe God wanted me to, you know, be active in my graduate, you know, pursuing my graduate degree. I believe God wanted me to stay married to my wife. And that meant doing less 12-step work than I was used to. What I did as I became active as a GSR, I tried to, you know, get into treatment facilities. I tried to go to as many meetings as I could. Sometimes that was only one meeting a week. But I always tried to reach out when I could. And I always tried to do my very best. And I put more emphasis on my meditation. I do, you know, I do 20 minutes of meditation a day. I have a sponsor. I'm more responsible. I guess doing less 12-step work makes the other, it gives me less leeway to mess around with the other parts of the program. Like my meditation, I can't really miss out on meditation these days. And then I'm stir crazy. I need to be spiritually accountable, you know. And what kept me going is that I went into general service here. And that's how I got to meet a lot of people. That's how I got acquainted a little bit, you know, knew what meetings to go to, stuff like that. You know? And I had sponsors, you know, sponsees. I was sponsoring still, like I told you guys, a lot of guys back home. And then I just continued greeting people here. I continued giving out my phone number, and I started to get some guys to work with. And now for probably the last just over a year, maybe a year and a half, maybe, I've pretty consistently been working with somebody, you know. Usually maybe it, you know, 3 weeks, 2 weeks pass in between, something like that, and then I'll get a new guy. But it's not as much as I used to do, and I'm still doing okay. And I'm still sober, and I still feel in touch with my God, as I understand. And I guess my experience with this is that I'm trying to do the best I can to do this deal. And I'm trying to follow God's direction in my life as I think He will have me be. And I guess I want to share that I don't need to limit myself just looking at the 12 step thinking, well, I can't do 30 hours a day. I'm not going to do this. You know what I'm saying? My God goes beyond that, you know, because this is about my relationship with God. Most of my experience suggests that that's directly in proportion with how much 12-step work I'm doing, but not always though. And I used to be more concrete about it. You know, I used to be more, I guess, rigid about it. My experience now suggests that what's most important to me, for me, is to be doing God's will. You know, is to be in that third step, and blindly doing 12-step work without God is not gonna, you know, keep me completely safe or unharmed. Because this is about God. AA is not about AA. You know? AA is about approaching God. In whatever way I think my God needs to be approached at that time. Whatever that means for me. That's what keeps me sober. AA does not keep me sober. The power that propels the universe keeps me sober. That's the only thing that can keep me sober. This power is clearly indicating to me today, as he's been doing for the last 9.5 years, that I should be active in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know? So my experience suggests that the amount of 12-step work I do is more related to doing my very best than the concrete amount. And again, not a lot of the guys I've been working with here seem to end up sober. You know, one of them just relapsed last week, and it's a beautiful thing. You know, then I get to wrestle some more sobriety out of them. This is good. I'm again working with a newcomer, right? So that completely validates my experience that I don't get paid by results in Alcoholics Anonymous. I get paid by the hour, no matter what the results are. It doesn't matter. I get paid by the hour. So I guess that's all I have. Do we want to do a Q&A thing again?
Yeah, let's do what we did last
week. Ah, okay. If there's anything, yeah.
Anybody have any questions before? I have a couple.
Okay.
So right now you go to your home group once a week and you're at the GSR for that. And then you work with a newcomer a couple nights a week, typically?
Yeah, something like that.
And then the second question, if you're working with a new guy, and someone else were to ask you to sponsor them, what do you do?
Well, now I would say yes. You know what I'm saying? If I would get a new guy that I feel is, and sometimes you kind of get a guy and you kind of feel he's atchy, so that would mean another yes. But if no, like we talked about last time, I would go and direct him so I could say I'm sorry, I'm not going to be able to do a good job working with you now. So, but I can definitely, introduce you to some people that can. Yeah.
Court, do you feel like it has made a difference on how long it's taken the people that have paid some of these sponsors to do the work, rather than, like, if you take them through rapidly, do they seem to have a better success rate, or just as long as they're
Well, yeah, I always. What do you mean a long time?
Well, I mean, I've heard some people saying that they've taken upwards of 6 months going to work.
Yeah, I've never done that. I have no experience with that. You know, taking such a long time. Some guys are gonna relapse, like we talked about, after a week if they don't get into the first step. Some guys can take, more time to do it, and that's the way I prefer. Like, if I can read through a book, but I try to meet them, at least hopefully two times a week, something like that. So it's not going to take that long. I think my real experience. I don't think that this is a huge factor unless it's a really long time that you take. Then the process is going to lose consistency, and the spiritual experience is probably not going to be as powerful, just because it's you lose consistency in the work when you take such a long time to do it. But the main thing is, is the guy going to start working with others or not? That's the main determinant in my experience. Is he going to get that and really work? Get that feeling that's going to be his first thing. When shit hits the fan, he's going to turn to a newcomer. And it takes some time to get to that place. If guys get to that place, that's the success. You know what I'm saying? That's the success, right? That determined. You know what I'm saying? So my main objective now is just to get guys to that place. From the very beginning, I start to talk about it. My main purpose here is to get you, into this, help you to get into this experience so you can work with others. And that's pretty clear, that's a clear objective of mine from the very beginning.
Do you write inventory on any kind of basis today? Have you written inventory recently or at all?
Yeah. I do it. I listen to, what's the story? It's Acceptance is the Answer, I think it's called now. It used to be called Dr. Alcoholic Addict. Mm-hmm. It's a story in the big book. Dr. Paul O, he I listened to a speak of his, and he said, you know, I work the steps and then rework the steps. And that's the kind of the approach I take. If I call inventory a 4-step or a 10-step, I really don't care. It's semantics, you know, as far as I'm concerned. But I used to write a 4-step from the big book every 6 months. Now I do it every year. Yeah. I feel one could do too much of it, if you will. You know? So going further up my ass instead of going to the newcomer, if you will. But then when you have sobriety and you're in the place of sponsoring a lot of guys, the 10-step gets easily away from you. You know, the nipples go into the air and you think you're all that, and you know what I'm saying? And you lose perspective. So I try to do it regularly, but not too often. Oh yeah, I've tried all kinds of things, you know. And there was a time in my sobriety, if you weren't doing 20 minutes in the morning and 20 times in the evening, you weren't sober. That's just the way it was for me. It's a little bit rigid. I have that tendency, just a teeny bit. Then I had some kids, and all that changed, right? Now I'm more flexible. Yeah, I've tried all kinds of methods. Now I just sit down and I watch my breath. You know, and I do the morning meditation from the big book. I review my day. I pray for the stuff, guidance I need to pray for, stuff like that. And then I sit down and, well, I'm sitting all the time, you know. And then I just try to watch my breath and pay attention. I read a autobiography by a Buddhist monk who had enlightenment at the age of 68 and lived to the ripe old age of 120 years old. And he still called his mind the mad mind. Buddhists meditating for 50 years, they call their mind the mad monkey or the caged monkey, you know. So, you know, I'm pretty tolerant about how my head is. And I just sit, I breathe, I use my breath as an anchor, you know, breathe in and out through my nose, I have my spine straight. And then I just pay attention and watch myself. And I lose track. And then when I notice that I'm off track, I'm somewhere else, I go back to the breath and I just repeat as necessary. And then I'm doing some other meditative stuff with some guys from AA, you know, in a group. I go to meditation retreats. I've done a course, and it's which is more part of my 11-step group. So, but basically all meditation techniques, in my experience, are being about basically having your spine straight and paying at using your breath.
So you're just trying to stay away from thoughts, and you're focusing on your breath, or
no, just paying attention. I a good way not to stay away from thought is trying to stay away from thought. It's completely impossible for me, at least. You know, just paying attention. You know, paying attention to the breath, paying attention to how I'm feeling in my body, what I'm thinking. You know, what's going on? Where am I? Yeah. Am I here right now? You know, I'm asleep. Usually I'm not here. Usually I'm not present. You know, that's just the way I am. So just the meditation practice is a little bit of an effort to try to be here now. Be where I am.
Does anybody have anything else? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Before we close, does anyone have any AA-related announcements they would like to share with us?
You'll see it, alcoholic.
Hi, Bill.
Just want to let everyone know that this meeting will not be held for the next 2 weeks.